Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Tiferet Talk. I'm Melissa Studdard, and this is the Blog Talk Radio show for Tiferet, a journal of spiritual literature, where we publish writings and engage in dialogue to promote peace in the individual and in the world. We're thrilled that you're with us right now, and we would love for you to also join our global online community at www.tiferetjournal.com. There, in addition to interacting with other members, reading their writings, and posting your own writings, you can subscribe to the journal, which in each issue presents high-quality poetry, prose, and art. As well, we'd like to take a moment to welcome two phenomenal editors to our staff, Gail Brandeis, our new nonfiction editor, and our Jeffries, our new associate editor. I'm delighted to announce also that our Jeffries will be joining me to co-host the show tonight. This evening's guest are the fabulous literary duo, poets Helen Cardona and John Fitzgerald. In addition to writing poetry, Cardona is an actor, translator, teacher, children's story writer, and dream analyst. She is the author of the bilingual poetry collections, Dreaming My Animal Selves, Life in Suspension, and The Astonished Universe. Of Cardona's Dreaming My Animal Selves, Jean Houston says, in this extraordinary volume of soul-crafted poetry, words become wands to enchant and evoke our better selves. Fitzgerald, in addition to writing poetry, is a novelist, editor, and lawyer. He is the author of Telling Time by the Shadows, The Mind, and the novel in verse Spring Water, which was a Turning Point Books Prize selection in 2005. His fourth collection, Favorite Bedtime Stories, is forthcoming from Salmon Poetry in 2014. Robert Nazarene says that Fitzgerald's Spring Water is to poetry what The Silence of the Lambs is to filmdom, a harrowing narrative trip that makes for an absolutely compelling read. Both Fitzgerald and Cardona have published widely in journals and anthologies, and together the couple wrote the screenplay Primates based on Fitzgerald's novel. Hello, is everyone there?
Yes. I am.
Hello, Melissa and Jeffrey.
Hello. Okay, I hear the two of you. Wonderful. And is John here, too?
Yes, I'm here, too. Nice to meet you.
Hi, John. Hi. Welcome, everyone. I'm so happy to have you all with me tonight.
Thank you so much. What a treat. We're thrilled.
Terrific. So I'm going to go ahead and jump in with a question. Helen and John, individually, you two are each an amazing powerhouse, but together you're a veritable force of nature. So what I want to know is how you two support and encourage each other, and how has your relationship contributed to your growth as artists? Helen, would you start?
Well, it's really quite magical because we met through poetry. That's how we met. I heard John read, and I was thoroughly enchanted. And so our relationship started in a very old-fashioned way. We started writing each other and sending each other poetry poems. And we are very, very, he's my number one supporter and vice versa. You know, we just are the first to read each other's work, and we inspire each other as well. Yeah.
That's wonderful. John, what do you have to say about it?
Yeah, I think that pretty much sums it up, really. We're supportive of each other. Basically, that's about it, really.
Okay, well, great. Well, you know, you two are both so successful in other fields, and yet you choose to also write poetry, which tells me that you must have a deep belief in and love for poetry, because, you know, we don't make a lot of money doing that. And
right.
Helen, you know, you could just sit back and say, hey, I'm a movie star, look what I've done. But, you know, in that one area alone, you've accomplished more than most people will. So my question is, why poetry? What is it about it that is so fundamental to you that you feel like you need to do it? John, why don't you go first this time?
Well, really, I'm compelled to do it. That's I don't feel like I have much of a choice, really. The only reason I'm a lawyer is just to make a living so that I can write poetry. pretty much I'm a lawyer on the side, really. what I'm about is really just writing. Even my job as a lawyer is writing pleadings and motions for the federal court. But when I get home at night, this is how I spend my time, just reading and writing, and pretty much spend all my time researching things, reading and writing them. And that's who I am, really.
Wonderful. I love that. You work to support your writing.
Yeah.
And Helen, how about you?
Yes, Melissa, I feel it chooses me, and maybe as an artist you feel the same way, that, you know, art chooses us and we serve it. It's like, you know, I started writing when I was 10 or 11, writing poetry. It's something that was just for me a way to express myself. You know, it's just a way to fulfill myself to transcend, you know, experiences into something that is going to be healing and beautiful. So both, you know, the poetry and the acting serve that purpose.
Wonderful. And you come from a family with poetry in your background,
yeah.
Right?
So, you know, my
father.
My father is a poet, and he's actually a Spaniard. He was born on the island of Ibiza, Spain, and he a few years ago now, I went back with him because the government of Ibiza published an anthology of his work called the Birnam Wood, named after the Shakespeare play, you know, the Birnam Wood in Macbeth. So it has a political, you know, aspect content. It's an anthology of his work. He had two books of poetry published, and he had been widely published in journals. And he basically, the reason I was born in Paris and my brother in Geneva is because he had to exile himself from the Franco dictatorship. And
wow.
So, because of his writing, right? So he
wow.
yeah, he what just you? Escaped, and he wrote very much about, you know, the land, you know, where he comes from, and also the need to be free. And so I guess that's also partly in the genes, you know, and John being a Fitzgerald, and his father also had a way with words. Maybe we have something that you know, comes to us through our parents that way. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I grew up in a household that was filled with books. And reading, I started reading very early, you know, just because that's what was going on around me.
<That's wonderful.
laughs> You know?
How interesting to be exiled because of something you've written, too. I mean, it just shows how powerful.
It's incredibly powerful,
writing,
isn't it? And
no?
Yes, and it's the first thing that dictators are afraid is that, you know, is it's just amazing. They just have to control people's mind and their minds, and one way to do it is by not allowing access to the written word, basically, or the spoken word, for people not to be able to express themselves. And so it's just amazing the lack of imagination of dictatorships. You know, you can see how people. So the writers that, you know, the art that comes out of a country like Spain under Franco, it's really interesting because it's when there's censorship, one has to be more creative also in order to disguise, you know, themes. And they're not too bright, you know, dictators, so you have to disguise.
So, everybody knows what we're talking about right now.
So it's very, you know, it becomes subtle and you decipher, you read through the lines. Yeah.
That's wonderful. Thank you. Jeff, do you want to ask a question? You've been
Yeah,
quiet.
I do, Melissa. Thank you. I just want to make a quick statement and just say that I am incredibly honored and thrilled to now be a part of the wonderful Tefera Journal staff. It's an amazing community.
Thank you. We're so happy.
Actually, didn't fail me.
Congratulations.
Honored.
Yes.
And to thank you for asking me to co-host tonight as well, Melissa. It's and have an opportunity to speak with Helen again. And hi, Helen, and hi, John.
Hi, Jeff. It's such a pleasure.
You're
such
welcome.
A pleasure. Yes. Yeah. I very much appreciate it.
I honestly say that I'm going to try my very best to enjoy being in the company of two incredibly talented, beautiful women, all when indignities one must endure, but I'll try.
Well, thank you. We appreciate your efforts.
You're most welcome. Helen, I have a question for you and also for John as well. I know there are certain things you must do as an actress to prepare for your roles. And John, likewise, you must prepare a lot of paperwork for cases as an attorney. Are there ways in which your preparation in these other careers aids or mirrors your writing process? Helen, would you answer first, please?
Are there ways in which?
They mirror your writing process.
Oh, yes, of course, of course. Well, I think, yeah, I think everything does, you know, and especially other artistic endeavors act as a stimuli. So in terms of, it's very specific when it comes to me and the connection with acting because, and it's very magical, because when I lived in New York, I was introduced to Ellen Burstyn, you know, at the Actors Studio, and I was able to study with her, which was really a great privilege. She only taught two classes, workshops, you know, and she introduced me. She was the first one to introduce me to guided meditations as a process to open up, travel to places, you know, that the conscious mind doesn't have access to necessarily. And, you know, in a bit accessing an altered state through meditation. And then I met Sandra Seacat, also through the Actors Studio, who's an extraordinary coach. And she introduced me. She was the first one to introduce me to dream work, which is something that I've been doing now for many years and that I'm also able to help others with. And the dream work is basically, when I started this type of work was to help me peel the layers of characters, you know, I was working on. And I found out that actually it's a tool, a healing tool, basically, to dreams are there to basically help you in life, you know, in general, because you hold the answers, you do. And so you just dig deep within and, you know, ask your inner self questions and the dream will reveal them. And then you have to decipher the dream. So that's been very productive for writing. It's been, you know, mining my dreams. And so this book in particular is inspired by several dreams I had. And some of them were like tales, you know.
Helen, because what you're talking about relates so much to the poems that I'd like to have you read, do you all mind if you read your poems before John answers the question?
It's so interconnected.
It's the perfect time to talk about it. So just be great if you could read those poems. We'll talk about them just a little bit, and then we can go to John answering that question.
Sure. So I'll read From the Heart with Grace, or both of them, or just one?
Yes, From the Heart with Grace, please.
From the Heart with Grace.
Both of them together,
okay.
If you could, and read the sexiest flower first, if you don't mind.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
The sexiest flower. Orchids seduce sultry swans shaped like us. Their primal mouths entice ghost cocoons aglow in moonlight. Subliminal animals whose elegance and passion for the theater fixate on perfection. Sanguine or virginal, they take 4 years to flower and cast their spell. Their irid lids caress secrets of orange tentacles, purple tongues, gold robes dripping jewels, luscious lips that cauterize our desires in their everness. Their bold mastery and downward glances bewitch and summon us to Cythera.
Wonderful. Let me just
beautiful.
Say, very quickly, interject, don't mean to interrupt, but just there's nothing better than having a wonderful poet read their work to you, getting the right inflection, tonality. Wonderful. Please continue, Lynn.
Thank you,
thank you,
Jeff.
Absolutely.
Thank you. From the heart with grace, a wind who yearns to be savored offers me 3 cups overflowing with eternity. Daemon of insight. The opportune encounter enraptures quintessential distress, ruffles estranged quietude, kindles a jeu d'esprit, glückliche Reise, propels the fervent fragrance of heliotrope, hyacinth, and honeysuckle. The tremulous hibiscus taunts me to warm climates, reminds me I remain a thistle, resilient, rooted in Mediterranean Celtic fringe. Do you remember a language older than time, when a shiver down my mother's spine was worth 1,000 words, and the melancholy in my father's eyes, reflecting Lake Geneva, was indecipherable? There, unbeknownst to me, in a world inhabited by swans, I too swim in concentric circles, to find the resonance of my core and discover that in dreaming lies the healing of earth. In dreaming, we travel to a place where all is forgiven. In dreaming is the divine created. And the great oneness whispers ex voto, I am centaur by any other name. I am griffin by any other name. I am mermaid by any other name. My raison d'être, insubstantial, chameleon, excavated like a talisman from wreckage, resplendented fresco, catapulted beyond whimsical, metamorphic frontiers.
Excellent.
Well, I have to say that's my favorite poem of yours, so I'm so glad you read it tonight.
Thank you.
Beautiful reading, too, and you see why I wanted you to read this in conjunction with what we were just talking about, because you really do walk that dreamscape in these poems, and you bring the bounty of the unconscious back out to the light, and I love that. So I wanted to see, you talked already about dreaming and art and dreaming and poetry and how that's all interrelated, but something that you touched on in From Heart with Grace is that in dreaming lies the healing of the earth and the resonance of your core. And so I wanted to see if you could elaborate on that a little bit.
Yes, because we are whole, like we are connected, we are connected to the divine in the dream. We have access to the oneness, we're one, you know, with everything, right? So that's the place where we can find ourselves whole. And so whatever is going on that need repairing, that's where, you know, the remedy lies, basically. We have, you know how the brain is. We have the old reptilian brain, which is when we, you know, were reptiles on Earth. The first brain that evolved, you know, into the mammalian brain, the feeling brain, basically, that mammals have, where, you know, now emotions is involved. And then we have the neocortex for, you know, the human species evolved. So beyond that, you know, is the pineal gland. And it's like when you dream, you know, all the brains shut down one after the next until that's the the only thing left, you know, where you're just connected to all through that pineal gland. You know, it's like the place where definitely we have access to where we came from and where we're going when we leave our persona, you know, our outer self, you know, at the end of this life. Yeah.
Absolutely. Thank you. I have a little bit more. I might want to ask you about that later, but first I want to see if Jeff has anything he wants to say.
I wanted
about.
To ask John if he would, and thank you, John, for letting us sort of circumvent your answer. If you'd like to answer that question as well, if you need me.
Yes, great.
Dan.
The question was about how my job interacts with...
Exactly. In any ways in which you prepare in your other careers, how they aid or marry your writing process?
Well, like I said, I write motions and pleadings for the federal court. I don't really have to appear there. The cases I do are done in writing. I never have to go and argue and be standing up in court. It's all done in writing. The U.S. attorney is the guy on the other side, and we're just writing back and forth to the court, and whoever wins, wins. And I'm basically representing disabled people, and the other side's representing the government. I don't find very much that contributes to my ability to write poetry. It's more like an outcropping of the type of person I am who just is interested in researching and writing things.
Well, I wonder, John, if there may be a connection between you being your empathy in pleading that case as well as the empathy that's in your writing. I think we all, to be relatable to our readers, must have empathy in our work. It's my feeling.
Oh, yeah, I agree with that. Everybody has to have empathy. I mean, that's kind of... what makes us able to connect with other people. There's experiments that show that when you they actually did this with a monkey, and they show that when you see something happening to another person, it registers in you as if it's really happening to you.
I've seen that exactly.
Yeah, and it's
wow.
A very interesting thing that I think in the future, as humans continue to progress, it's possible that the power of empathy will possibly, you know, just in fact, one of the poems that I sent you is about that the power of humans to like progress to a point where, you know, because there have been on Earth up to now at least 24 species of humans, all of which have gone extinct except for us. And we like to think that we're the pinnacle of success and that there's no progressing beyond what we have achieved.
Right.
But the fact is, evolution didn't stop. It's still going on right now. It didn't end with us, and it's happening now. And the best thing that could probably happen to humans is they progress into something else, that they become more advanced and might even be considered to be a completely different species from what we are now. The way, like when we look back in time, for example, if you look back to the Middle Ages or back to prehistory, back where people seem to be barbaric, I think that there will be a time in the future when people then will look at us right now and think the same thing. Like, boy, though, how do they ever get through?
I'm already thinking it, John.
Yeah.
I've been biting my tongue trying to say, well... You know, does that mean to evolve past Walmart, and I'm good to go?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, well, that's amazing. Well, would you read your poems now that we've done the same thing? We've gone into the territory, so let's hear the poems.
Yeah. Okay.
And Oh, go ahead, please.
In either order, or do you have a preference? Or
I'm so glad you asked. I'm really not a control freak, but I do have a preferential order for both of you.
Okay.
I would love to hear The Man Who Knew Everything and then The Becoming.
Okay. Both of these will appear in my next upcoming book from Salmon.
Wonderful. If you want to give us the title of that?
It's Favorite Bedtime Stories. And,
okay, terrific.
And it'll come out in 2014. So this is called The Man Who Knew Everything. Sapiens number 7 billion. And it's the same with me as with every other human. I formed immersed in a dark sack of fluid and bore through a tunnel into the light. From that time, I have never been alone. From that time, too, I have always been. I am a hypothetical being. Every person born of my line, the day and year and place that I was, and given my features, strengths, and limitations, would almost certainly be me. For over a year did I write certain nights when I could, orator for the planet with a voice like dirt and a few odd ghosts behind me. Herein lies the testament of Earth. A statement much too much for me to bear. It overwhelms me, and I am afraid. I have no proof. I am poet and cannot explain. I will go into the other room to drink. My God, my love is way out of control. All manner of loneliness I pray to. I will be like the far thoughts of paper when the word existed before it was spoken.
Wow, that was so powerful.
That's my word, Alyssa. Thank you. I was just going to say that exactly. Powerful.
Thank you.
Wow.
And that was recently published in The Passionate Transitory, so I'll just give a shout-out to them.
Congratulations.
Oh, great. Yes.
Yeah, thank you. And so the other one was called The Becoming. That was recently published in the Toronto Quarterly, so I'll shout it out to them, too. It begins with an epigraph by Hermes Trismegistus. That which is above is from that which is below, and that which is below is from that which is above, working the miracles of one. So it's called The Becoming. I have become one of these humans. From beyond, I return in the literal way, with account of both the transit and its feeling. Thought recedes like a land bridge covered with sea, in the days when the flood struck awe in every heart to set me once again among you. It has been so long. I come down from above your lights, on a red eye over metropolises, aglow with electricity, from Atlanta to far-stretching city of angels. I come down, backward in time, across shades of altitude and night. It has been so long. Atlanteans, Angelinos, I pod unto thee, over waves and basic cables, fiber optically, eye glass and fire worked. It has been so very long. I reappear thrice great to now, philosopher over all Earth's meanings, an architect mistook in scripture, a little one, already ancient, with cracks for veins, to the latent pagan icons, to the Latin and classical Greek, it has been so long, to the offspring of Ardi and Lucy and Otzi, to the Jutes and the Saxons and Celts, it has been so long, humans, time to move, we are of another age, revising, reliers on dogma, so long, borders all over the globe, so long, for I am lover of the word since the beginning, and that earth seems to move, I believe. It is a fool who grows a crop and does not harvest, for he is left with a crop of insects. The thoughts of the mind are a crop. Take these in and realize. So long, disconnected descendants, misleaders and users, so long. You knew or should have known what gets scratched by flesh into stone. Thus I am born among sapiens to exact humanity. You swear when you hear I am coiner of words, my poem a garment painted rosily. Sing to it erect it at the fair. Impress whatever tiny spark in you may listen. 114 million years ago, the first flower spat its never-seen color out of earth. A flower heretofore latent in humans is about to burst. Spread the word, now understanding is at hand. The new human, with a book 13 billion years in the making. God, it has been so long.
Wow.
Oh.
So that's powerful.
Can we, it may be a good time for it, interject a question from chat for our guests.
Definitely.
And let me, since John was very graceful to thank the journals, before the poems are read, before they were published in the book by Salmon Poetry, Dreaming My Animal Selves, I definitely want to thank Thrush Poetry Journal and its editor, Helen Vittoria, for publishing From the Heart with Grace, you know, your favorite poem, Melissa.
Yeah.
It was nominated for Best of the Net and for a Pushcart Prize, and also was published in the Toronto Quarterly, in which you were published as well, right? And for Poetry Month, all of us, actually, John, you and I were there for April Poetry Month. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one, The Sexist Flower, was published in Recours au Poème, which is publishing poetry in both English and French. So definitely my grateful thanks.
Oh, thank you, Helen. That was very, very nice. Thank you. Jeff, do you want to interject from the chat room?
Yeah, there's a question in chat that Donna thought would be nice for us to ask. It's from Michael Hansen, and it's for both Helen and John. What they think of the importance of public readings is to the act of poets. Nice question.
I think it's great for poets to read, you know, for us to read our work in public, for an audience to discover the poets that way. The poems have a different energy when they're spoken out loud than when they're read. So if you can read your poems and convey that, is wonderful. Not every poet is a good reader, so you know it's not, you know, it's tricky. So it's an art, you know, and some are performance poets as well, which is an altogether different animal, right? But I think it's wonderful to connect with the audience for the poets, you know, as well. It's a kind of a communion of sorts.
You know, Helen, when I first recognized you online on Facebook, the first photo I saw of you was you were standing under a tent at a small dais and reading a poetry, and I said, "What a lovely scene!" Didn't know who you were. It just came up in my feed, and then I said, "Oh, she's a poet and an actress." That was my first introduction to you.
I love it. Thank you.
I recall what I wrote you, and I wrote, "This is one of the most beautiful photos I've ever seen."
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Well, now I want to see the picture. You're going to have to post it for everyone. Jeff?
Well, I will. And John, your response?
Well, yeah, I think it's good to for people to hear the poems the way they're intended. You might, at least as far as I'm concerned, I think every syllable in the poem is there for a reason. Nothing is to be thrown away. Like I like them to be read slowly. I write them. I've read my poems out loud to myself a thousand times, and basically, I think it's, you know, historically an oral tradition. The way humans used to keep track of their own history and where they thought they came from before they invented writing was all done orally, in even things like the recipe for beer was written in a poem, and the way people transmitted their knowledge about their own history was through the poets, and who in historic times were, you know, basically second to the king. A poet could make or break a person. For example, there's a woman named Sybil Ludington. I don't know if you've ever heard of Sybil Ludington, but the same night that Paul Revere rode across yelling that the British are coming, Sybil Ludington was 17 years old. She rode twice as far as he did the exact same thing, but no one's ever heard of her because no one wrote a poem about her.
John, I'm in Massachusetts, so yeah, I learned about that as a kid, exactly, and she's unheard of. And that's a great point. I'm part Native American descent, Eastern Cherokee, and they're still trying to construct a written language for it because it was always oral and always hands down, the knowledge.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
So
yeah.
I think it's important.
John, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the poems that you read, too. The flower, this flower that's latent in humans and about to bloom, what a wonderful concept that is. And we talk about empathy, and you talk about understanding in the poem. Is there anything else that you want to say about the flower?
Well, I think that, as I said, that right now, people are still progressing, that they will either go extinct or they'll reach a point where they progress even further, and they'll look back on us as if we were cavemen. That's going on right now. We'll either reach that or we'll go extinct.
Is that why it's important to you to talk about it in the context of prehistory, because the scope of that poem is so huge? And even in the other poem, there was a sort of prehistory when you talk about the word before it was spoken.
Yeah.
And I'm just fascinated with that aspect of your work.
Yeah, because I just look at everything as one long continuum. You know, right now I'm writing a book of nonfiction about everything that's happened from the Big Bang to now. And when you see things in that sort of a timeline, it affords you a really a perspective that everyone should have at an early age. I wish I would have figured it out before the age I am now, which I won't say, but it was, I wish I would have figured it out a long time ago. I wasted a lot of time and not knowing what was really going on.
Will you make a children's book then?
Well,
so
I think it's the book I'm writing is not necessarily a children's book, but children should read it.
okay.
Everyone should read it, yeah.
Great.
Because that particular concept, I mean, there was a time when there were no flowers on Earth, and mm-hmm. there's a day when the first one, you know, the first one sprouted, and mm-hmm. And there was a time when the only color on Earth was every plant was green, and there's a day when the first purple one pops up. And now, of course, you know, we have all the colors as far as the whole spectrum of colors, but it wasn't always like that. And not only that, but there's a chance that it's part of the human consciousness that even makes that perception possible.
Right.
Who knows if it really exists outside of the way we think.
Right. Anna
and Helen, you've both read poems now, and I'd like to ask you this question, which I think is in the back of every writer's mind, and especially the poet. What connections are you most seeking to make with the people who read your poetry? What do you want them to come away from? What do you want them to feel or be? We all want to change them. I know when I write, I want people to, you know, to obviously be understood what he's saying and not have to run to a dictionary. But be understandable. What do you want people to take from your work? And Ellen,
well,
please first.
Yes. The first thing is to connect. You know, I love the writer E.M. Forster, and that's one of you know, his quotes only connect. And I think that's the most basic thing for us human beings is to connect. So that connection with others, I think, is primordial, you know, for us to exist, to connect. And so, and the, you know, and then the other thing is to move, you know, for people to go through an experience and be transformed somehow. So whether they connect, whether they relate, because everything, you know, is also, even though the poems are written from a very personal experience, at the same time they have universality and right, and you can connect to them. So that's how we build bridges, and that's how, you know, we're art has this enormous impact, because we read somebody else's words and they affect us. So as long as that is happening, and you know, something very strange happened one day when my first book came out. I went to do a reading. I think it was at the Theosophical Society, or I forget where it was, but I went to do a reading, and I signed a few books. And I think the next day or a couple of days later, I receive a phone call by a guy. And I think I had dedicated this book to this lady, and I had given her my phone number as well. And and this guy says to me, it was very eerie. He said he found my book walking on the street, picked it up, and he felt so moved and so connected, you know, after reading it. And it happened at a specific time in his life. The book was very helpful to him. It was, you know, it was almost, it had almost of a supernatural quality to it. And he phoned me, and I was dumbfounded, because in a way the book had found its reader. For some reason the lady was meant to lose it. I don't know how you drop a book on the street and not notice it, right? And he was meant to find it, and he just went on and on. He just really wanted to tell me about how much, you know, this book meant to him, and he didn't want to meet me. He didn't have any questions. He just wanted to let me know that, and I never forgot that.
How wonderful.
That's wonderful. Wow. It was really, really meant for him to find that book, wasn't it?
Yes, because I know that's how it happens for me. Like, you know, how I'll find a book at a certain time in my life, you know, on my own in a bookstore or through a friend or, you know, or online. And it'll be just what I needed at the time, you know. Or you know how you go through life, you know, through school by reading certain books, and some will really have an impact on you. You'll just connect with some more than with others, and they to the extent that they will change your life, you know. So yes, it's all about connecting in these different ways.
I love the way you said the book found the reader instead of he found the book on the street. The book found the reader. That's just, it's magical. I want all the books to go and find the people who need them.
You know? Well, you know, everything is energy, right? Like, we are all connected to absolutely everything, right? And to one another, but to absolutely everything. Everything has energy. We're all made of the same stuff, right? Atoms, and so I believe everything has energy. Even inanimate objects, they and especially ones that have been, you know, that carry our DNA, because they have our words on them, even more so.
Mm-hmm. Yes. John, did you have anything to add to that?
No, I think that summed it up pretty well.
I think so, too. I was thinking, you know, this question was addressed to both of them, but what else is there to say?
Yeah, there's nothing.
You know, you just said it. Well, you know, actually, why don't you start with the next one? I would love to know about the screenplay that you guys wrote together and the novel that it's based on. So if you'd like to start telling us about that, John, I would love to hear about it.
Yeah, it's called Primate. Basically, it's the story of a chimpanzee that is stolen from Africa and smuggled to the Florida Keys. In the process of it being stolen, its mother and family are all killed And it's a baby chimpanzee. And they bring it, smuggle it to the Florida Keys to a place that's owned by a pharmaceutical company. And they have an island. It's an island that is just dedicated to raising monkeys for scientific research. And the chimpanzee and certain other, they're called bonobo apes, are raised in what they make is a kind of rainforest in a dome. And they raise these animals there, trying to teach the adults to communicate. And they're trying to teach them sign language, but they don't really catch on. But the baby, just kind of by osmosis, catches on and is able to use sign language proficiently, and can basically have a conversation with the scientist that works there, who's been teaching it. And a few years go by, and he gets bigger and smarter and stronger, and then he runs across the guy who kidnapped him and messes him up pretty badly. Doesn't kill him, but messes him up pretty badly. And in the trial to determine whether this chimpanzee should be destroyed, he is allowed to testify on his own behalf because he speaks sign language. And so that's what the story is about, an ape who testifies in court because he can speak sign language. And
that sounds amazing.
Yeah, so that's what it is. And so I wrote the novel first, and then Helen and I adapted it to a screenplay.
Okay, well, gosh, I can't wait to see that. That sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Everybody seems to like the story.
Helen, I wanted to ask you about translation, since you do so much of it. You translate your own and others' work, and I wanted to see if you could talk a little bit about what you've learned about writing from doing translation.
Enormously. That's such a good question. Enormously, because you just discover, I've discovered new words. I've been translating this poet, Jean-Claude Renard, this French poet, extremely spiritual, whose writing is just very transcendent. And he's not very easily accessible because you have to enter that realm that he lives in, and the language he uses is so incredibly beautiful, and so for me, I find it very enriching. You know, it's the more you read, or you know, you learn a different language, or you just become better at writing as a result. So
Wow, I can imagine, and I like what you said about just you learn a new word because, right, you have to look it up to translate it, and then you know it, and it's in your bag for your next poem or your next,
Absolutely. And my father, writes in Spanish, and I've been translating him too, and he writes in very heightened language, you know, like Ezra Pound, and that's also a different world to inhabit, so you just you're like clay, you know, and you just molds you, you know, it just betters you to the more you translate, I think. Sorry?
Do you read the poems aloud to yourself when you're doing the translations?
Yeah, I mean, I don't start out that way, but eventually I do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I would too. And you know, when I was getting ready for this evening, I actually read your and John's poems aloud to myself a few times, and it's just it's exciting to taste someone else's language like that. And then to hear you guys read it and how it was different from the way I read it was just kind of amazing, really. So, Jeff, we are going to be winding down pretty soon. We've only got about 10 minutes left, so I wanted to see if there are any last things that you'd like to ask. And
thank you, Melissa. We have we are planning ourselves an AWP conference next year on the West Coast. And Helene, you were here for the Boston conference this year. I wanted to know what your experience was like doing that.
Yes, I will share that with you. One word: madness. John and I have been attending the Writers' Conference now, you know, these conferences for, I think, 7 years. And it's a wonderful way to, you know, meet poets from other parts of the country or the world. And I'm presenting each time. I present, you know, at least one panel, and it's usually a translation panel. This last one I had also a publishing panel that I was doing, and, you know, several readings. But it's you know, it's so many people in one place, you know, in time, hundreds. I forget exactly how many were there, but it's thousands.
Tens of thousands.
It's just such pure madness, and it's so hectic. And you know, at first, I think in the beginning, you want to attend, you know, as many panels as possible, and then in the end, you're just so wiped out that you just decide, okay, I'm just going to do this and that, and I'm just going to try and have, you know, a good time and not put too much on my plate, you know. But it's just a sheer
interacting with the people, Helene, and having people come up and ask you this question for being on the panel. Tell me just a little more detail about just that one-on-one experience.
Well, the wonderful thing about the panels is, well, the ones you attend is, you know, you the discoveries you make, and then the ones you do, the people who come, that's how I met the Pedro Serrano, for instance, who's the editor of the Periódico de Poesía, the journal from the Mexico, the university, Mexico City University. And he offered me to write an article about the poetry of my father, you know, for the journal. So that was a wonderful opportunity that came out of, you know, him attending my panel. Or a few years ago, I was invited to read at Brown University also as a result of, you know, a panel I did. So I think you just never know. You have to remain very open and for encounters, basically. You know, for me, it's all magical encounters. You know, each time you do something, that you put something out in the world, and if your spirit is generous, you know, if you share, which, you know, John and I do, we like putting people in touch. And then I think the universe responds back, and you have people come up to you as well with, you know, saying we'd like to extend this invitation to you as well, and that's, I think, what makes, you know, it fun, basically. I call that the magic of it, you know. The
I totally agree, because it's all about making those connections. They can be lifelong connections too, just from introducing one person to another. They connect and they stay connected forever. It's wonderful.
Yeah, plus our publishers in Ireland, so like we either have to go all the way there, or they
yeah.
meet us partway.
No, it's true, because our publisher comes to the Writers' Conference, so it's a great opportunity to support her, you know, to be there. There are two things going on. There's the conference, and there's the book fair, and then all the publishers have booths at the book fair tables, you know, with the books. And so they set up, you know, signings for the authors, and the authors, you know, you browse, you go to your own, you know, publishers and support them there, and you also go visit others and see, you know, what the new books are and who's there, you know, signing their books. So that's very important, to go and meet your publishers.
I must, Helene, should give another shout-out to Salmon Publishing and Jesse. Just wonderful, wonderful publisher. You have found a wonderful, nurturing home there, I believe.
Oh, absolutely. Jesse Landon is extraordinary. She's just, first, she's a fantastic poet herself. I mean, she's such a beautiful, beautiful poet. And then she just, you know, has this love for for poetry, poets, you know, writers, and supports them in the most incredible way. And Ireland is a country that really supports its poets and writers. You had a post, Melissa, on Facebook about that, you know, what are our values, what is it we value,
why?
What is it we're willing to, you know, when you think of it, why do we choose to pay certain people more than others, you know, why is it not that the educators are paid the most, you know, the scientists, you know, pop culture is what it is, right? And you want education to reach the most people, so it elevates, you know, the level of you know, the quality of life for everyone, basically.
Right.
And so it's the same, you know, with food, the fast food, you know, those are the most popular, and they do very well, these businesses, and the more literary books, sometimes the you know, and poetry is a heightened way of expression, so it's not always accessible, or people think so because they haven't been exposed to it. I think if you start reading it early, or if it's like just having a cup of tea, it's nothing, you know, unusual, then it doesn't become something like, oh, I don't know if I, you know what I'm saying?
Oh, so, I know exactly what you mean. Yes.
So a country like Ireland, for instance, on its bank bills, you know, its note bills, on its money, has the faces of poets and writers, you know, and Mexico does too, and you can see the value, you know, of the importance, like John spoke about the importance of poets throughout history. And not only that, in Ireland, writers don't pay taxes on the money they earn from their writing. So, you know.
That should be worldwide.
I never knew that. Thank you, Willen. I guess I was going for France, but I may switch over to Ireland. I didn't know that.
We'll all be moving to Ireland.
We're there.
And how funny.
And John's Irish, too, right?
Because
John's
I know,
again,
we're running out of time, and thank you so much.
Yes.
It's been an absolute pleasure to get to speak
yes.
with and interview again, Helen. It's been marvelous. And, John, really nice to connect your voice with your post on Facebook and your picture. Pleasure. Hope we can speak again as well. And Melissa, thank you again, and thank you to Donna and the Tefera Church.
Well, we'll meet
you.
Soon.
Well,
hopefully, we'll meet. Yeah, we'll meet in Seattle, Jeff.
I have two last questions that I want to pose to both of you before we all hang up. I would like for each of you just to take a minute and tell our listeners about your most recently published book, just a little bit about the book, what it's about, where they can find it, and also if you have any other readings, events, publications, just anything coming up that you would like to let us know about, and how to get to your website if you have one. So that's three. I meant to say two.
All right. So in a nutshell, my book is called Dreaming My Animal Selves. My website, so it's published by Salmon Poetry. You can find it on the Salmon Poetry website, which is salmonpoetry.com. You can also find it on Amazon. And I know it's on, you know, all Goodreads and all, you know, it's everywhere else. But right now, because it's brand new, it's actually coming out, you know, basically this week in the U.S. So it's on sale for a short time on Amazon because of the launch. It's for me, the idea of the book was to give voice to mutable selves, you know, all the many hats I've worn over the years, you know, through the prism of dreams, myth, legend, and fantasy. And it's a book inhabited by animals who are a constant in my life. So that's in a nutshell.
Okay.
John?
And my most recent book is The Mind. It's also from Salmon Poetry. So it's on their website and at Amazon.com.
And,
okay.
And my website, I don't know if I said it, but it's myname.com. It's HelenCardona.com, which is spelled HelenCardona.com. And another thing about my book, which is going to interest some people, is it's bilingual, written in both French and English. So the poems face the translation on the page, so for the Francophiles. And there's a foreword and introduction by Brian Turner. So I'm very grateful to Brian to that, and to Willis Barnstone and David Mason and Thomas McCarthy, who's an extraordinary Irish poet, for their endorsements, you know, which mean the world. And, of course, Jean Houston, the extraordinary mythologist, you know.
Yeah.
That was
Wonderful. Well, thank you both so much for telling us about your most recent works and also for being here. It's just been a delight to speak with both of you and learn more about what drives your work and everything. So thank you. And thank you, Jeff, for helping me host the show. It's always wonderful to have you with me.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Melissa, so much, so very much.
Yeah, thank you both so much.
Melissa,
you're
and Jeff,
most welcome.
So much.
And y'all have a wonderful night, and we'll probably meet y'all in Seattle next year.
Yes, if not sooner.
Good night,
for sure.
Everyone. Thank
if
you
not
so
sooner.
Much.
All right, thank
okay.
You very much.
Good
thank
night,
you.
Everyone.
Bye.
Good night.
Bye bye. And before we close, I'd like to let our listeners know that there will be poetry by both John and Helene in upcoming Tiferet issues. You can subscribe, donate, or purchase single issues of the journal at our website, www.teferetjournal.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the new Tiferet Talk book, a collection of interviews from the first year of Tiferet Talk Radio. And also have a look at the special invitation from Hay House Publishers to join authors Gabrielle Bernstein, Chris Carr, Nancy Levin, and Reed Tracy for a writer's workshop in New York City, June 22nd to 23rd. Our next Tiferet Talk interview will be May 20th at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time with Molly Peacock, poet, creative nonfiction writer, and former president of the Poetry Society of America. We'll be focusing on her book, The Paper Garden, Mrs. Delaney Begins Her Life's Work at 72. We hope you'll join us then. And in the meantime, we wish you peace, love, happiness, and fulfilling work. Goodbye.